All right, good morning, everybody. We're going to be looking at Hebrews chapter 8, showing, in some ways, wrapping up how Jesus is the superior priest, like we've been looking at from chapters 5 through 7. But it's also transitioning to talking more about how Jesus brings the greater sacrifice, which is still connected to the priesthood work, but it gives a special emphasis on the contrast of the blood of bulls and goats and things like that. So that's what we're going to be starting to look at this morning. And again, here's the oversimplified outline of the book of Hebrews. And hopefully seeing this gets maybe the scaffolding in your mind of what we're looking at. Chapters 1 through 10 loosely could be described as doctrine, even though there's lots of warning sections with application mixed into it. But he's giving them the teachings about how Jesus is superior, first of all, to angels and then to Moses, to the priesthood and then the sacrifices. Really, chapters 5 through 10 could sort of be placed together in some ways because the priests were the ones that gave the sacrifices. But if you wanted to parse it out a little bit, that's how we could do that. And that's how we've been talking about this as we've been going through this. But after the final warning section from the first 10 chapters and at the end of chapter 10, chapters 11, 12, and 13 is calling the audience especially to be disciplined in light of all of this great information that they've been given. And so that's where we're going as we look at this. Dan Blimline is going to open us up in a word of prayer as we get started this morning. All right, let me introduce what we're looking at to maybe add some context to the concept of Jesus being the greater priest and the sacrifices that he makes. But in religion, there's typically two main components to a religion. And the first is some kind of a belief in an ultimate reality, maybe the ultimate ideal or some kind of God that they believe in or something like that. And the second component to religion is that there's a gap between that person and that ultimate reality that needs to be bridged in some way. And so what Hebrews has been showing as we've been looking at this, in chapter 8, verse 1, the text that we're looking at this morning, he says that the main point about what he's writing is that we have such a great high priest who's gone into the presence of God, those kinds of ideas that we've seen before. And so when we see that Jesus is this great high priest, he's the priests represent the people to God. And so Jesus is the one that bridges this gap by fulfilling the role of being that priest. Maybe one point to make from that we hadn't made in the last couple weeks is that when a Christian really understands these ideas, it creates somebody who's been restored. The gap has been bridged. But it's not been because of your perfection, unlike any other religion. All the other religions say that you need to do all of these things, and it depends on your effort, and then maybe you'll bridge that gap. But Christianity teaches that Jesus is the one that did that. So it creates people who have been restored, but at the same time, we're humble because it's the work of God that has made that possible. And so those are some maybe introductory things to say about even what we're looking at this morning. But the outline of chapter 8 for the section we're looking at is in verses 1 through 5, it's going to show you that Jesus has a superior ministry or service in comparison to the priesthoods of the Old Testament. And then in verses 6 through 13, he's going to show how the covenant that he brings and ministers to, or is the minister of, is also superior from what we've seen in the Old Testament. So that's where we're going this morning. Any comments or questions by way of introduction before we start looking at the text this morning? All right, Jack Johnson is going to be reading for us this morning. So, Jack, do you want to read 8, 1 through 5?
Now, the point in what we are saying is this. We have such a high priest, one who is seated at the right hand of the throne of the majesty in heaven, a minister in the holy places, in the true tent that the Lord set up, not man. For every high priest is appointed to offer gifts and sacrifices. Thus, it is necessary for the priest also to have something to offer. Now, if he were on earth, he would not be a priest at all, since there are priests who offer gifts according to the law. They serve a copy and a shadow of the heavenly things. For when Moses was about to erect the tent, he was instructed by God, saying, "See that you make everything according to the pattern that was shown to you on the mountain."
All right, I want to direct our attention, first of all, to verse 5. Because he talks about how these things in the Old Testament were copies or shadows of what Jesus was going to bring. This is the first time that we see these words in Hebrews. He's going to bring them up again a couple times in chapter 9. He's going to bring it up in chapter 10 as well. So let me just start out with this question as we look at this stuff. What is the idea of a copy or a shadow from the Old Testament? What does that mean, or what does that imply? There's a lot to unpack with that. Okay, good. So it's not the real thing. What else? It's an image of the real thing. What else? It resembles the real thing. Yeah. Yes, it's not going to be as perfected. Very good. Any other things that you guys would add to this? Yeah, it points to the real thing. We're kind of like how we're made in the image of God, and so we're supposed to reflect and point to God, but God is the real one, and stuff like that. So there's maybe some parallels with that. I thought I saw another hand, though. Yeah, the type and the anatype. You've maybe seen the illustration before with the typewriter, how it had the, if you guys have ever seen one of those before, how it has like the type, and then the anatype is when it actually goes onto the paper, but it's the molding that makes the shape of the letter and stuff like that. Good. All right, so here... Okay, good. Yeah, copies are temporary. The real thing is different in that way. Copies are not valuable like the real thing. Maybe think about... I've heard this illustration before, and I like this. But remember, like, the baseball gloves that kids would get that would have, like, the fake signatures of their favorite baseball players? A kid might get that and get really excited about that, but it's not the real signature, so the glove's not worth as much money as if it were the real thing. So the copy is not as valuable. Or the shadows are not substantive like the real thing. The shadow just kind of represents the substance. And so when he says in verse 5 that Moses was given this pattern, it implies that there was an original of everything that he was making, that he was being instructed to write down and make for the tabernacle and stuff like that. The reality is in the heavenly realm. Now, I want to point out maybe this application from verse 5, that if God has instructed somebody to do something that's a pattern of a greater reality, does it matter that you follow the pattern the way that he's laid it out? It does, because let's say that I'm given a pattern on how to make... I remember when I took a sewing class in 8th grade, because I was really cool. I had to get a pattern to make pajama pants and stuff like that. And if you don't follow the pattern the right way, you're not going to resemble the thing that was in the picture that shows you what it was supposed to be. So you get the reality wrong when you misrepresent the pattern, or you don't do the pattern the right way. And so I want to maybe think about an application from this. This is teaching us a principle. Are there any things that God has left us today, or maybe throughout all of history, that is a pattern that points to a greater reality, that we must respect the pattern so that we can properly represent that reality? I think, for example, about marriage. Marriage is kind of like a pattern or a copy of what? Of the church, Christ and the church, right? What if a husband and wife decide that they don't want to honor marriage the way that God has said? You're misrepresenting the reality by not honoring the copy that he's given us. And so maybe there's some other ways that we could flesh that out or not, but is there anything you guys want to say just about that before we see what the shadows are in this text? All right, notice that in this section here, in verses 1 and in verse 3, Jesus is the one who offers the real sacrifice. The priests in the Old Testament, it says in verse 3 that it was necessary for them to bring a sacrifice. And we're going to see as we go through this, the priest had to offer the unblemished animals. We saw at the end of chapter 7, though. Do you remember how Jesus was described at the end of chapter 7? Like in verse 26? For it was indeed fitting that we should have such a high priest, holy, innocent, unstained, separated from sinners, and exalted above the heavens. These are the same kinds of descriptions that you would see for the Old Testament sacrifices. So the priest would offer the unblemished animals. Jesus was the unblemished sacrifice. So that in verse 1, now he's seated, and it shows that it was a sacrifice that was done once and for all. We've talked about this before as we've gone through Hebrews, that in the tabernacle, there was no chair. And I think maybe the implication of that is that the work always had to be continued. But Jesus is able to sit down. All right, so that's him offering the real sacrifice. All of the blood of bulls and goats are looking toward this reality that he brought. Anything you guys want to add to just on that point before we look at the next copy and shadow? All right, the second one in this text is that he's the one who serves in the real tabernacle. The priest served in the replica of it. But then Jesus is the one that serves actually in God's presence. This is maybe another way to think about some of these things. But if there's a kid that plays with like little Tonka trucks and stuff like that, but he eventually gets old enough to be able to drive them and use them in one way or another, you're going to kind of put away the copies and shadows and go with the reality. And so this is what Jesus has come to bring. Let me just bring up one point, maybe of doctrinal application from some of this. There's a lot of people that teach and believe that Jesus is going to come back for a little literal 1,000-year reign, and that when he does that, they're going to reinstitute the sacrifices, and they're going to rebuild the temple, which all of that misses that the reality is what is in the heavenly realms where Jesus is currently. That's bringing back the copies and the shadows, and those have been done away with now because Jesus is the reality. All right, so that's Jesus' superior ministry. He's offering the real sacrifice. He's the one that's in the real tabernacle. And we're going to move to talking about the greater covenant that he brings. But is there anything else anybody wants to add to or ask about some of this? Jack? Right. Yeah, when you see how... So like Abigail is 2 years old, Asher is 4. I remember when Asher was 1 years old or 1 year old, whatever, and Abigail's the age she is now. Looking at Asher at age 4, I can kind of go back and see the pictures from when he was 1 or 2 and maybe could kind of see how he began to look the way that he did. But if I was to look at him as a one-year-old, I wouldn't be able to project out and say, you're going to look like this when you're 4. You can only see it in hindsight. And so I think in some ways that's sort of what the Old Testament is like. You get these pictures and ideas, and you know, maybe it's going to be like this, maybe. But you don't really see the full picture until the new covenant is brought. And then you can go back and reread the Old Testament and go, okay, I can see where we got to from what we had in the Old Testament. And so it could only be the mind of God that would have created all these things. These are the sorts of things that I think build faith. And again, think about the audience to whom he's writing. Their property's been seized. They're going through persecution. And in order to inspire them and get these people to stay encouraged, he doesn't give them a bunch of fluffy, nice-sounding sort of promises. He actually gives them substantive things that they have to engage their intellect with, which will help keep them grounded. If your intellect doesn't get engaged in a deep way, you're not ready for the storms that are going to come. All right, so good point. Anything else you guys want to add to or comment on with that? Yeah, David? Right. 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 And I think you can, in that, you can see the temptation to create graven images and stuff like that, because this is tangible, it's right in front of me. But it takes faith and trust in God that the greater reality is beyond the things that we can see with our eyes. So that's a really good point. All right, let's then look at the nature of this new covenant that he brings. Before we read the text, though, I want to say a couple things just about the concept of covenant that I think will help us dial down and understand what we're looking at here. So let's think about this question first of all. What is a covenant? Let me give you the basic definition of it, and then we're going to talk about different kinds of covenant in the Bible. So I would say the basic understanding of what a covenant is some kind of an alliance, or it's some kind of a partnership. But throughout the Bible, there's different kinds of covenants. And so what are the different varieties that we see in the Bible? What would you guys say about that question? Okay, good. So there's requirements on both sides. So maybe we could say when Jacob is marrying Rachel and Leah, and he agrees with Laban that he's going to work an extra 7 years, and then he can have Rachel. That's kind of like, okay, we're going to agree on these terms. We were going to both fulfill our roles that we have in that. So that'd be more of a contract in that way. In Genesis chapter 12, when God gives the covenant or the promise to Abraham, do you see any kind of conditions in Genesis chapter 12? At least when the initial promises are given. No, it's just, I'm going to bless you, I'm going to make your nation great, all of that sort of thing. We see in Genesis 22 that he also had to obey. But when the promise is originally given, there's no conditions given to it. And so sometimes a covenant could be tied to a promise where one person is obligating themselves to something. Also in the Bible, historically, there's something called an obligatory covenant. Where, let's say, for example, that there's one weak nation that is in trouble financially, or maybe there's another nation about to attack them, and then a greater nation comes and rescues them. That greater nation can then enter into what was called an obligatory covenant, or a suzerain vassal covenant, if you want to know that. And the greater one wouldn't really even negotiate with the lesser nation. They would say, these are the stipulations, you can agree to it or not. But if you agree to it and you obey, there's going to be blessings. If you disagree, then there's going to be curses. And so when we talk about Jesus instituting a covenant, would we understand it to be like a contract where we all sat down with him and we said, okay, Jesus, we'll agree to it if you change this, maybe lower the price a little bit on that and make it so we can maybe have the moral flexibility to do these things. And he goes, okay, I really need you. So let's go ahead. I'll go ahead and sign. I don't like that idea of a contract with what Jesus has done. Certainly what Jesus has done involves a lot of promises, but I think the kind of covenant that Jesus brings fits the ancient model of an obligatory one, where we were the ones that were in need. He was the one and came and saved us and offered that to us, and we can either take it or leave it, and if we leave it, we're going to be cursed. We're not the one that sets the terms at all. So what we have with Christ is not a contract. I think it would be more of the ancient model that we see there. All right. Maybe something else to say about covenants in the Old Testament time period. They were oftentimes ratified by blood. And the way that they would do this is, remember in Genesis 15, Abraham is put to sleep and then God makes this covenant. Kind of like, remember, Adam is put to sleep and then he's got his bride. So God does that a couple times in Genesis. But he cuts these animals in half, and then God comes in the form of a flaming torch. And do you remember what he does? He passes through the aisle. Do you know why in the ancient world, when people would talk about cutting a deal, they would cut animals in half and then walk down the aisle of the animal? Do you know why they did that? Yeah, Jason? Yeah, that's right. And Jeremiah, the reason I put Jeremiah 34:18 up there is because that shows it very, very clearly. Where there's people that broke a covenant and God is threatening them that they're going to become like the animals that they passed through. Can you imagine if every marriage had people passing through dead animals? And as they passed through it, they looked at them and go, okay, that's going to happen to me. if I don't obey the covenant. All right. In Genesis 15, God is the only one that passes through the aisle. Abraham doesn't. And I think part of the point of that is God is saying, I who am immutable, I'm the one who can't die, but I'm going to put myself in a position where that might happen to me. And eventually that's what he does in Jesus. And so every covenant has to be ratified by blood. That's how you seal the deal. That's how you cut the deal. And so what Jesus is bringing is only possible through the blood that he sacrificed. We're going to see more of that in chapters 9 and 10. But any comments or questions about that? That's some technical information, but I think it might help us as we look at this text. All right, just for your information, I don't know if this is interesting or not. It's interesting to track the major covenants throughout the Bible. You've got the covenant with Abraham, Israel, David, where he's going to have the one that's going to reign on the throne forever. And then you've got the new covenant that we have now. There's a couple more that we could add to that. But all of these are connected in one way or another. And they're all looking forward to the one that we have. All right, so with that being said, Jack, do you want to read verses 6 through 13?
But as it is, Christ has obtained a ministry that is as much more excellent than the old as the covenant he mediates is better, since it is enacted on better promises. For if that first covenant had been faultless, there would have been no occasion to look for a second. For he finds fault with them when he says, "Behold, the days are coming, declares the Lord, when I will establish a new covenant with the house of Israel and with the house of Judah, not like the covenant I made with their fathers, on the day when I took them by the hand to bring them out of the land of Egypt. For they did not continue in my covenant. And so I showed no concern for them, declares the Lord. For this is the covenant that I will make with the house of Israel after those days, declares the Lord. I will put my laws into their minds and write them on their hearts, and I will be their God, and they shall be my people. And they shall not teach each one his neighbor and each one his brother, saying, Know the Lord. For they shall all know me, from the least of them to the greatest. For I will be merciful towards their iniquities, and I will remember their sins no more." In speaking of a new covenant, he makes the first one obsolete. And what is becoming obsolete and growing old is ready to vanish away.
All right, just interesting facts about the Bible. What we just read here is the longest Old Testament quote in the New Testament, Jeremiah 31, and what he says here. I want to direct your attention specifically first, though, to verse 13. Because he says in verse 13 about this quote that Jeremiah made, that in speaking of a new covenant, he makes the first one obsolete, and what is becoming obsolete and growing old is ready to vanish away. Some people have taken this verse to mean that this must mean that this is really close to the destruction of the temple, because once the temple is destroyed, then all the old covenant system is going to be made obsolete and stuff like that, and you can maybe make that argument. But I think what he's saying here in verse 13 is that when Jeremiah made this prophecy started to make the old covenant obsolete, because we already know now that there's going to be something greater. Think, for example, let's say that you have, what year is it right now? 2019? Okay. You have a 2019 Toyota Camry, because those are the best cars. And you see a commercial that the 2020 Toyota Camry is going to be coming out. And as soon as you see that commercial and that news is released, how do you start thinking about your 2019 Camry? It's obsolete now. Like, there's news that something else is coming. And so I think the point of what he's saying here is that when Jeremiah said these things, it started to diminish the old covenant, because the old covenant itself now was saying that there's something greater coming. And now, in the time of the writing of Hebrews, it's ready to just completely vanish away. It's been growing dimmer and dimmer and dimmer since the prophecy, and now it is. All right, so let's start back at the beginning then of this section, in verses 7 through 9. He says that there was fault with the, and he doesn't use the term first covenant, or old covenant, he uses the term first covenant. What was what was wrong with the first covenant in this text? And I think there's two sides of the same coin that we could talk about with this. It relied on man, like in his effort and stuff like that. Okay, what else? Okay, you had to be done over and over. Okay, so here's one thing to say about this. The covenant itself, though containing glory, like 2 Corinthians 3 says, the covenant itself was incomplete. And I think the reason for that, he says it in chapter 7 a couple times, that this system couldn't make anybody perfect. But in chapter 10, verse 4, he's going to say that animal sacrifices cannot remove sin. It can't solve the problem that people have. So that's part of what's the problem with this. But there's another side to the same coin. What does he say in verse 8? Who is the fault with in verse 8? The people. So the covenant itself was incomplete, but also the people had a history of disobedience. In verse 8, he finds fault with them. In verse 9, they did not follow in the covenant. Have you ever noticed that in the Old Testament, there's a pattern of God giving instructions and then people disobeying the instructions? So go back to Genesis chapter 2. God tells Adam, you can eat of any tree, but not this one. And then in the next chapter, what happens? They do it. Think about when they're at Mount Sinai and they receive the Ten Commandments. And then Moses comes down from the mountain. And what are they doing when he comes down? They're breaking a lot of the Ten Commandments. You think also about Nadab and Abihu. You just got done getting all of these instructions about how you're supposed to make the sacrifices, how it's supposed to work, and then immediately they disobey. Do you know how many stories there are in the book of Leviticus? There's two stories. Nadab and Abihu, and then there's a story of a kid who curses God or blasphemes God in chapter 24. Guess what that is in the context of? In Leviticus like 18 through 24-ish, it's talking about honoring God and holding his name with reverence. And then you've got a story of a kid who doesn't do that. And then also you've got Korah's rebellion. In Numbers chapter 15, you've got laws. And then in Numbers 16, you've got people disobeying. You can, if you go through the Torah, the first five books of the Bible, and you look for some kind of instruction, look, within the next few chapters, there's people typically disobeying the things that they said. So you see in verse 9, when it says that these people did not continue in the covenant, you see that so clearly in the first five books of the Bible. And so maybe the point that we can make from this is that the system that they had was inadequate for the needs that they had because of their sin and because of the regular need to make sacrifices. There needed to be something that was going to be a more permanent fix. And this is what Jesus brings. All right, I've done a lot of talking for a couple of minutes, so is there anything anybody wants to add to that or ask about it? All right. So if we were to then look at verses 6 through 13, or I guess really 10 through 12, there are certain passages in the Old Testament that give descriptions of what New Testament Christianity was going to look like. And this is this passage gives a lot of detail about what Christianity is supposed to look like. And so if you just scan verses 10 through 12, ask yourself this question. Am I part of this covenant? Does this properly describe who I am? So for example, let's look at some of these descriptions of New Covenant people. I would suggest, first of all, that they're going to be people who are peaceful. Because look who he's making this covenant with. It's with the house of Israel and the house of Judah. Now, why does that matter in the time of Jeremiah, when Jeremiah writes this prophecy? What was the relationship like between the house of Israel and the house of Judah? They were adversaries. You go read 1 Kings, especially shortly after the split with Rehoboam and Jeroboam, and one of the things that it keeps saying about the kings is that the kings of the north were fighting the kings of the south, the kings of the south were fighting the kings of the north, that there was war in their days. And so for Jeremiah, around that time period, to come and say, God is going to make a new covenant and he's going to bring back fierce rivals, means that what he's saying here, the spiritual meaning of this, is that people who are really part of the new covenant, they're not going to use earthly distinctions to continue any kind of rivalries. All right, in a room this size, and when we all worship together, are there different political opinions that people have here? Can we all work together still? Are there different socioeconomic statuses that we have? Can we all work together still? Are there a lot of reasons why the world's going to have divisions but those divisions ought not exist amongst God's people. I think this is part of the point that he's making. Fierce rivalries from the Old Testament, those earthly distinctions won't matter in the new, with New Covenant people. Anything you guys want to say about that? I think that's a significant thing that sometimes gets missed in this prophecy. Yeah. Right. Yeah, when the temple is finally destroyed, that's kind of like the death blow on all of this, and it shows very clearly that the new covenant is the way to go now. So, anything else? I thought I saw another hand. Yeah, Jason. Yes. That's right. Have you ever noticed in Acts chapter 1, verse 8, it kind of gives the outline of the book, how you're going to be my witnesses in Jerusalem, and then Judea, and where else? Samaria. Have you ever just paused and thought what he's actually saying there? Like, this new covenant is going to combine you guys in Jerusalem with people in Judea, that's okay, but also Samaria, and then also the ends of the earth. If you want to write down Ezekiel 37:22, it prophesies that that sort of thing is going to happen. All right. Anything else about how these people are going to have peace with one another? Doesn't mean that we never have to bear up with each other and we're going to have personality differences and sometimes we're going to rub each other the wrong way. But the point is that we're going to work through those things, is the idea. All right. Notice something else. That these people delight in God. In verse 10... God's law is going to be on their minds and it's going to be written on their hearts. If you go back to Hebrews chapter 3, verse 10, it talks about the wilderness generation. And look at Hebrews 3:10, where it's quoting Psalm 95. And it says, "Therefore I was provoked with that generation and said, they always go astray in their heart. They have not known my ways." So that wilderness generation, they didn't delight in God. God's laws were not written on their heart. In fact, Jeremiah 17, in the same book as this prophecy that we're reading, a few chapters earlier, Jeremiah said that what's actually engraved in your heart is sin. But then in Jeremiah 31, God's going to change their hearts. So the new covenant people are not going to look at God's commands as burdensome. They're not going to look at them as some kind of drag. I got to do this thing that God has said. That doesn't mean that there's going to be never going to be times where my will doesn't want to do what God has asked. But if my greatest desire more than anything else is to please God and honor Him, then I'm still going to do the things I don't feel like doing. But that proves that my greatest desire still is to please God. So ultimately, they don't look at God's commands as burdensome. So maybe a challenge that we should ask ourselves with this: do you actually love learning about God? Do you love, is it your delight to do what God says? I think I've heard people say, there's a lot of bashing about cell phone usage in our culture. What if every time somebody had their phone, they were actually reading the Bible, though? Like, as zealously as you read your text, and you got to do that because we're social creatures and everything like that. But what if we were reading our Bibles as much as we were zealous about sports or other things like that? New covenant people, this is their passion. And this is... I could say more about that, but I'll leave it at that unless anybody has any comments or questions. Yeah, Jack? Yeah, so the question then becomes, how does God do this in the New Covenant? That's a good question. What role? At minimum, we can say that the Holy Spirit has revealed more of God's will. And so in that way, the Holy Spirit's been involved in writing it on our hearts because He's made more available to us. But what would you guys say about this? How is it that in the New Covenant, this is true about us to maybe a greater degree when you have somebody like King David, who obviously loved the law of God and he meditated on it. So that was true about him even in the Old Covenant. So how does this happen in the New Covenant? Yeah, because we love God, which is inspired by, I think, in the context of Hebrews, the greater sacrifice that he offered. If Jesus has offered a greater sacrifice and he's shown a kind of grace that no other religion offers, and he's shown a kind of sacrifice that was never really in the Old Testament, we had pictures and shadows of it. Because of how much more God has done for us, it ought to inspire this in us. And so I think the more we meditate on the love of God for us, we become these kinds of people because we want to serve the one that's done so much for us. I think the greater sacrifice is what inspires this. But is the Holy Spirit involved in this? Yeah, I think so. Vera? Good. And I think from passages like this, I really think that one of the biggest struggle of the Christian, in my 30 years of vast wisdom, I think one of the biggest struggles for a Christian is learning to appreciate what we have. Because if I learn to appreciate more what we have, it would inspire a greater delight in God. That I don't like it that the song Jesus Loves Me is just associated as a children's song. For me, I've said this before, that's one of the most profound, hardest things in the Bible for me to grapple with. And I think we need to be reminded of that all the time. You see the greater sacrifice, the greater love that he's manifested under the New Covenant. If that doesn't change you, then you don't understand it yet. Wayne? Right. This is why I started with the contrast of... So one of the differences with Christianity from every other religion is that we're not meriting our salvation. Jesus is the one who bridged the gap. If every other religion depends on my going through the 8 steps to gain enlightenment and my effort, I'm not saying Christians are not going to put effort into it, but if what's dependent on me is that I achieve this kind of perfection and then maybe I can... Why is it that religions sometimes create very arrogant people? It's when you think everything rides on you and you think you're doing pretty well. What the book of Hebrews is doing is it's showing you that Jesus was the one that bridged the gap. It's not our perfection that's got us here. And when that really sinks into our heart, it creates people that delight in God and not delight, like the Pharisees did, in their own works and how great they are and how much they pray and everything. Because they thought that those are the things that were getting them there. But it was Jesus that bridged the gap. Yeah. Yeah. And that gets to the next one in verse 11. This new covenant is also characterized with intimacy. They will all know me, from the least of them to the greatest of them. Again, showing that earthly distinctions don't matter in the new covenant. From the least to the greatest, they all know me. In the Old Testament, a boy was circumcised on what day? Eighth day. Just a quick little side thing. Remember when David lost his son when he sinned with Bathsheba? Do you remember what day the son died? It was on the seventh day. So it was the day right before he would have been circumcised. And so in the Old Testament time period, you were put into this covenant with God at age 8. Now, how much of God did you understand? None. And so you can imagine a kid growing up, he turns 2 or 3 or 4 or whatever, and mom and dad are introducing their kid to the God to whom they're in covenant with. But in the new covenant, the only kind of people that join are the kind of people that have first learned some things about God. And so when it says that they won't teach each other, saying, "Know the Lord, for they shall all know me," the point of this is that for a new convert, I don't have to say, "Hey, do you know who Jesus is?" Well, of course they do. That they signed up to follow him. Now, can we still help each other understand God in a greater way? Yeah, but we don't have to introduce each other to God because we already knew God, and that's why we joined the covenant. But that's why we let him add us to the covenant. It's characterized by intimacy. Notice also, it's characterized by people that mercy has been shown to, which kind of goes back to some of these things we've been talking about. But in verse 12, "I will remember their sins no more." Was God merciful in the Old Testament, though? In Exodus 34, it says that God is a God of steadfast love and mercy and all of that, forgiving people and all that sort of thing. So I think the idea of this is that this is contrasting every year on the Day of Atonement. They would be reminded that they have sin. When he says, "I will remember their sin no more," he's saying that there's not going to be any more of them. Okay, maybe the Lord's Supper helps us remember. But it's not the same kind of thing that they had under the Old Covenant, where every year and the high priest would go into the holy place. Jesus is permanently there for us right now. Lindsay? Right. Right. Good. And then 2 Corinthians 3 says that we are the letters of Christ, because he's inscribing us for the world to read and understand. So, good. Something else to say about this then is that if we've been shown this kind of mercy, how often do you think about things that you've done in the past and you're like, I'm so ashamed of that, I grieve over that, which I understand that, but do we ever think that because of the things that we've done in the past, I might not be able to be with God forever one day, when the Bible says that it's been forgiven? And so new covenant people, I think, have a degree of assurance. It doesn't mean that you can't lose your salvation. But sometimes we say that so quickly to almost just make us feel like we're teetering all the time. This text says that I will remember their sins no more. You can lose your salvation. Hebrews teaches that. But at the same time, a new covenant Christian ought to have, I think, a greater degree of assurance than they did even in the old covenant. We've got a priest that has an indestructible life. He cannot die. And he's always living to make intercession for us. That's supposed to give us some comfort, I think. So, anything else you guys would say about what this new covenant offers us, or what we're supposed to be like from this passage? Yeah, Jason. Yeah. Right. And then as you continue to read Jeremiah, like, so in Jeremiah 31, there's going to be a new deliverer, there's going to be a new kind of exodus and everything. Jeremiah gives some really cool descriptions of the new covenant. So, for example, in a couple chapters later, in Jeremiah 33, verse 9, it says, "And this city shall be to me a name of joy, a praise, and a glory before all the nations of the earth." In other words, God wants to glorify his people amongst all the people of the earth so that people will connect us with God and they see why we're different. Who shall hear of all the good that I've done for them. And then it says, they shall fear and tremble because of all the good and all the prosperity I provided for it. They shall tremble in Jeremiah 33, verse 9. Have you ever seen what Jesus has done for us and the sacrifice that, and it's made you just tremble because of how good he's been to you? These are descriptions of what we're supposed to be experiencing. And so I think sometimes when some of these prophets are neglected, it's not good for us because these are supposed to describe who we are. But all right, we're out of time. So thank you guys for your discussion and comments.